Chapter 15, Marengo Pie. Chaos was giving a concert when Sean opened his eyes. If the melody was a loose improvisation on the themes of panic and disorder, the crack, boom, whoosh of dozens of cannons provided a more disciplined bass section. There were whistles of heavy lumps of metal in the air, while the ground jumped like a drum to a cannonball beat. There was a choir of screams of pain drawn largely from the heavy motif of corporeal dismemberment, and bellows of orders, whinnies in response, and other horsey things with hoof rhythmics, some results of which added creaks of gun carriages being rush-pulled along a recently rain-besogged road. Sean looked down at himself. He was wearing a similar blue and white uniform to the others, but jutting out the ragged bottoms of his breeches were young, bare feet that by the look at them had probably never known boots. He wasn't carrying a musket like the others, but a drum was strung around his neck, on which he was unconsciously beating as insistent a rhythm as possible. When the thick, acrid wads of smoke permitted, he could see he was standing on the side of a congested road, next to a field of what was previously parade ground straight rows of rank and file wheat, now just rank. There were vineyards to his right and farmhouses to his left. Very European farmhouses. European, as in not really Egyptian by any stretch of any imagination. Sean's memory cache slotted the rest of the way into place. This was not Alexandria, Egypt. The uniforms, the weapons, the location, all contributed to a piecing together of some reasonably consistent profile of when and where he was. But the thing that really Global Time positioned it for him was the man who was evidently the commander-in-chief. Sean had seen the uniform, hat, eagle-esque nose, and, while honesty is upon us, distinctive diminutive stature of this man in many of his history books. It was Napoleon Bonaparte, first consul of France. As it turned out, this was June the 14th, 1800, and this was the plain of Marengo, Piedmont, Italy. The blue-jacketed French Revolutionary Army was engaged in a brutal life-to-death struggle with the white-uniformed Austrian-Hungarian Army. And the road they were standing next to bore a tombstone-like road marker, saying something to the effect of, "Alessandria, not a too far, this away." When reality hits dead center, it really thuds. He had programmed his time jump for Alexandria, but had not taken into account that there was more than one. Providence, as many had noted, is somewhat hard of hearing. Taking advantage of Napoleon's petit boubou in dividing his forces the day before. All day the Austrian troops had been pouring in unexpected force out of the town of Alessandria onto the plain around the village of Marengo. And after a murderous rite of passage disagreement across an irrigation ditch, their numerical superiority had finally broken the French lines, and they were now hounding Napoleon's retreating army relentlessly. Since it takes a good 30 seconds to reload a musket, the two sides had ample opportunity to engage in some delightfully creative bilingual name-calling. Perhaps because of his sensitivity to small stature jokes, Napoleon was standing with his back to the advancing Austrians. In front of him were not his general staff, but a military band. A heavily decorated officer risked interrupting him. "Your Excellency, the Austrians are overrunning us."
"It is not my fault if the Austrians do not follow my battle plan. I don't see why not. I sent them a copy just yesterday. Don't bother me, Lanz. I am busy with the victory celebrations. Or are you going to tell me there will be no victory celebrations?" he growled low and threateningly to the broader group.
The dozen senior officers, crouching from the fire coming from the advancing Austrian line, some longing to join the fleeing French troops streaming past them, looked at each other, but none were brave enough to tell First Consul Napoleon Bonaparte he had already lost the battle.
"Good," continued Napoleon. "So, if you don't mind, The musicians and I have some rehearsing to do. Please get on with the battle and try to keep it down a bit. We can't hear ourselves play.
He turned to the score musicians in a semicircle in front of him. They were holding dented and scratched trumpets, horns, mud-clogged woodwinds, drums, shrilling fifes, and the one remaining bassoon had had its top blown off.
Now, gentlemen, one more time. All hail the conquering hero. From the top, and play it as if you mean it.
He conducted with a still glowing cannon taper. The terrified band began its discordant attempt at the piece. Just before the reprieve, a cannonball bowled down the brass section. The clarinets lost the beat, again, while some other elements of non-musical nature went permanently astray. Napoleon threw down his improvised baton.
Oh, sacre nerd, these Austrian philistines. How can I hear the pianissimo if there is all this raclette? Kellerman!
Napoleon shouted at a cavalry officer.
Mon general, take your hussars and also those new cuirassiers over there.
He indicated a squadron of men wearing breastplates and red-plumed helmets, standing stiffly to one side, their horses expressing their nervousness in the traditional fashion. When Sean looked hard, he could discern in the cavalryman's eyes something a little beady and red, which occasionally reflected off their hyper-polished metal armour.
They can't be, said Sean to himself, fixated by their diode eyes.
First Consul Bonaparte continued,
Kellerman, be so good as to take your cavalry and request the enemy to put a sock in it. We are trying to rehearse.
Oui, mon petit général.
Kellerman rode off to assemble his cavalry, ready for the charge of the heaviest brigade there had ever been.
Sound the charge,
ordered Napoleon, and Sean beat Gloire de la République.
Non, non, nous ne regrettons rien, on his tommy drum.
The column of cavalry moved forward, drew their sabres, formed a parade ground, the so-called squeaky door manoeuvre, despite the rain of munitions all around them, and with wild yells based roughly on a hastily hypothesized immortality theory, charged the Austrian and Hungarian enemy where it would hurt the most, right between the Allies. The Austrian grenadiers were caught unprepared in the open. For an encore, the cavalry mounted, as is their wont, a second charge, sweeping the last of the enemy from the field, and giving the exhausted and near-routed French the much-needed breathing espace to rally and reconsider their early retirement plans.
Ah, that's better, said Bonaparte, as the Austrians' screams of panic subsided into the distance.
And soon the band, Sean amongst them, found itself advancing as they rehearsed, the music now a genuine victory march along the road to Alessandria. Holed up in the town, the Austrians surrendered and offered to run away from Italy by mutual agreement. After legalizing the runaway in a formal signing of an armistice, the commanders on both sides exchanged presents, thanked all those without whom the war would not have been possible, and departed. As for the band, their victory march was a triumph. So much so, in fact, what was left of the Marengo Victory Orchestra started a tour de farce of towns. Their first gig was to be at La Scala, the famous opera house in Milan, to a literally captive audience. The same cuirassier cavalry who had won the battle became their minders and ticket touts. With their beady red eyes, metallic voices, failed Italian and more successful sabres, they scoured the streets for an audience. And they were there in the theatre itself at each performance, to make sure the press-ganged members of the audience applauded enthusiastically
after each pièce the band performed on the famous stage. They even provided the special effects for the battle scenes in the show by sending musket balls whizzing over the heads of the audience. Unfortunately, due to their failure to grasp the basics of theatre design, this did cause some considerable casualties among the people in the boxes overhead. However, it was rationalised, since exclusive boxes were the privilege of the rich, this was entirely in keeping with the spirit of the revolution, so Napoleon, their road manager, let it pass. After one particularly bloody concert, a 50-year-oldish, elegantly dressed gentleman approached Sean, inclined his handsome head minimally, and enunciated in crisp, aristocratic garble.
"Young man, I must congratulate you on your baton rouge. How you managed to keep playing under fire during the battle, I will never know."
"Thank you, sir. It was..."
"Oh, no. I'm not interested. I said I will never know because I have no intention of ever finding out. My name is Laplace."
"Pierre-Simon Laplace? The Marquis de Laplace? The famous mathematician and astronomer who wrote the revolutionary celestial mechanics and was the tutor of the young Napoleon Bonaparte when he was a cadet at the military academy?"
"You've heard of me, then?"
No.
Sean tried to cover up his blunder. A drummer boy would not know such things. He thought to bow, and did so awkwardly, wondering what the regulation depth of inclination was in an egalitarian state.
Pleased to meet you."
"That's right." Laplace smiled strangely. "Yes, and more recently I was the Minister of the Interior to His Mostly Extreme Excellency, First Consul Napoleon Bonaparte."
"Was?"
"Yes. I had a bit of a run-out with his wife, Josephine." He shrugged.
"We all did."
"I don't understand." Laplace handed him an expensive-looking business card with a golden string attached. It read, "Pierre Simon de Laplace, the exiest Marquis of them all, ex-Minister of the Interior to the glorious French Republic."
Sean turned the card over and read some even gaudier embossing. "Pomps for every circumstance. Post-revolutionary, politically correct, grandeur, our speciality."
"You do decorating?" said Sean, as surprised as decorum allowed.
Laplace jerked the string and the card sailed back to him. He pocketed it quickly, then shrugged his nose into a wrinkle.
"What do you expect a Minister of the Interior to do? Gardens?" "Ah, the nobility is not what it used to be.
Not by the head count, at any rate. You were saying you had problems with Napoleon's wife?"
"Nappy," she would say to him. "Don't be such a wet blanket, Nappy. Mon Dieu, how he hated it when she called him that. And he would get into one of his humeurs, and c'est la vie for a country or two till he had calmed down."
As if on cue, Napoleon came into the dressing room, his uniform enormously red-sashed and opportunity portrait ready. His clerkily contrasting secretary, Bourienne, followed him with difficulty through the narrow door, weighed down by a portable desk hanging from a strap around his neck. Rising from his elegant stick-accessoried bow, Laplace said,
"Your Excellency,
I was just about to explain to our friend here about the day I made my little discovery. You see, Sean, while we were repapering the royal apartments, I found a little portrait by Leonardo da Vinci in His Excellency's private cabinet. La Gioconda, or Mona Lisa, as it is known in the pre-revolutionary catalogues."
Napoleon nodded. "And this Mona Lisa painting is intéressant, très intéressant indeed."
"Ah, Excellency, you have such acute ease," admired Laplace.
"Merci. Alors, they say no person knows for sure where the Mona was painted, or how she came to have such a magic smile."
"Is that important?" asked Sean, enigmatized to the spot, as to why the great Napoleon Bonaparte and the Marquis, albeit the serial ex-everything, de Laplace, should be holding such a conversation with a mere drummer boy.
"Listen, boy," continued the First Consul, "everything I say is important, clair? I first invaded Italy in the year 4 of the revolutionary calendar. otherwise known as 1,724-16. I found a codex, a collection of writings by Léonard de Vinci himself, his missing Cherry Lake Codex.
Cherry Lake Codex? Sean outblurted.
Have you read it?
Read it? I wrote it, Sean found himself saying. Or helped, at least. He finished lamely to temper the deficit on deference.
Did you just?
Said Napoleon with a confirming nod to Laplace. So, you can tell us which lake the Cherry Lake Codex refers to, the Marquis stated. Sean made the mistake of thinking over for a moment whether this would be a good idea.
Or you die, prompted Napoleon matter-of-factly.
He flicked up the desk lid, which slapped Bourrienne squarely on the nose, explaining its curious shape, and foraged among the ink and own-label brandy bottles till he found a pad of stenciled death-warrant chits. He then closed the lid and took one of the less-nibbled feather quills from behind his secretary's ear. Sean could see that several of the chits had already been used, and by the names on the stubs they had been made out for most of the music critics of Milan.
You know, Sean, I like my people to think of me as a compassionate man, but of course I am nothing of the sort. Bourrienne, what threat have I not used today?
His secretary shook a large document box upside down, and a single dusty decree came floating out. He handed it to his boss. This one, free equal brother? Napoleon snatched it from him and glared at him.
This liberté, égalité, fraternité thing is really getting on my nerves. Okay, what have we here?
He read the paper.
Bourrienne, this is an old one.
Bourrienne shrugged. There is no use-by date. Anyway, we are running low. I expect a delivery of fresh threats by the end of the week. It's you who insists on variety.
I don't want to get into a rut, Napoleon explained to Sean. This says, or I shall have you hung, drawn, and decimaled.
Decimaled? Inquired Sean with a rare melange of curious anxiety.
Yes, the French Republic has gone metric, explained Bourrienne proudly.
Sean thought it would be opportune to panic. Your Excellency, the Cherry Lake is Lago Ceresio, otherwise known as the Lake of Lugano, of Nostradamus fame, said Sean, faster than an unintended mouse click on a delete button.
Correct, said Napoleon to Sean's surprise. Just a testing. Bourrienne.
Napoleon scrunched up the warrant slip and tossed it expertly into the mouth of his secretary, who uncomplainingly swallowed it. So if you knew that already, why do you need me? Asked Sean, desperately seeking some comprehension node point.
Because, Jean Solpierre, answered Napoleon gently, Léonard left us a further clue that we cannot decipher. Sleep now, for tomorrow we voyages to Lugano.
I'm going home, smiled Sean, and dreamed that night of his house, Mammy, Pappy, and Nonno.